If you want to get stuff done, then you have come to the right place. This is the Get Stuff Done podcast, brought to you in association with RDI Worldwide, a weekly interview series with prominent and diverse people from around the world who will share their own unique insights on what it takes to get stuff done and their personal strategies for doing so. My name is Gordon Dudley, the creator of the Get Stuff Done project and host of this podcast. Thank you so much for being with us. We hope you enjoy this episode and would love to hear your feedback anytime. Let's get stuff done. Hello and welcome back to the Get Stuff Done podcast. Today I am joined by Dr. Eric Kim. He is somebody who I've known in Seoul for a number of years, and I'm really glad to have him on as a guest today because he has absolutely shown through his many different affiliations how you can get a lot of stuff done all at the same time. So let me tell you a little bit about him. He is currently an associate professor at the Graduate School of Business Administration, Keio University. He's also an adjunct professor at the Graduate School of Business at Yonsei University. Go Yonsei! And he's also the founder and CEO of DayCrunch Global, which he set up in 2016 and is a solution for companies to help alleviate the difficulties of making business and operational decisions with large amounts of data. And so he has been having a lot of success with that over the last 8 years, the same age as RDI, I should add. And Eric is also a regular and prominent guest on other national and international media outlets. So I'm very glad to have him as a guest today. Thanks for joining us, Eric.
Thank you very much. I'm very honored to join your show today. Yeah, be selected by you as a person that is not well organized, learning how to be organized.
Now, I'm going to jump right in. I know that you've given some TED talks at some different kind of places. Mm-hmm. I've seen you also your interviews on Arirang and other Korean major media channels. Are those kind of performances? Appearances, I should say. Do they make you nervous? Or are you not nervous because you've done it a lot and you get very comfortable about it? Or do you always get nervous and you have a way to manage your nerves?
It gives me a lot of alert because honestly, I get a little bit stressed before the broadcast by preparing for questioners because some area I would know, but news is about like the events that happened today or yesterday. So you really have to be up to date and you have to... if you were not following the news, you would have to follow it and give your opinion. So doing that with other work is sometimes a little bit stressful, but it's becoming a habit to me to think of, and it gives me a good opportunity to think about the world and learn something new by having to prepare for those kind of questions and interviews.
Sure. And so what is your routine to keep up to date with all that's going on in the world?
I read a lot of news, yeah. But honestly, when I'm really active in the media, then I really focus on reading and, you know, thinking about things. When I'm not really active in the media, then I focus on other things like research or company work or things like that. So I would say that I really focus on the things that are immediate to me as a deadline or a due date.
Okay. And so I like to ask my guests what a typical day looks like for them. I don't know whether, because you wear so many different hats, whether you have such a thing as a typical day, but generally, what are you spending most of your time doing?
When I wake up in the morning, my calendar tells me what I have to do for the day.
So you live by your calendar, do you?
Yes, I can't live without my calendar because...
Same here.
Yes, I record all of my meetings and important things that I have to do for the day. But I also remember important things to do. So I tend to do it right away because, you know, work piles up. So if I have to send a message to someone or if something comes up on my mind, I'm going to probably forget it after... couple of days if I don't get it done ASAP. So I tend to clear the items as soon as possible so that it doesn't get in the way of other things that might emerge tomorrow or, you know, a couple of days later.
Right. ASAP, you mentioned there, probably the most heavily used acronym, the most heavily used English acronym in Korea, probably, is ASAP. Often we don't, as service providers, we often don't get the opportunity to ask, when do you need this by? Not least because we probably know the answer. It will be ASAP, no matter what. But how do you balance your roles in education and then also managing and running your business?
So my primary role is focusing on business. So that's what I mostly do during the week. And I have certain dates that I focus on schools. So for example, if I'm doing lectures, it will be Friday afternoon to late afternoon to evening. So I get into the academic mode around that time. If I have to attend to faculty meetings or there's a faculty discussion that's going on, I focus my time around those dates that I have to really focus. So because the dates are pretty much predetermined, I can plan out my time splitting between work and, you know, school. But more importantly, I have to work during weekends. You know, my mind can never rest, I would say. Probably I would go home after work, but my mind is still working to think about what I should do, how do I get things done, and when I should get things done, and how I should get things done.
Got it. Have you always been in that mode, that kind of switched on mode, or is that something that has come since setting up your business particularly?
I would say that, so in a Korean joke, if you work hard when you're young, you're going to work hard when you're old. So it means that you don't get to relax when you're old because it becomes a habit for you. But what I also see is because you have the, you know, habits of working hard, more work will come to you when you get older.
Right.
But I would say that I keep myself really busy and try to do a lot of things. I try to live fully since I was in college ages, and that habit continued, I would say, or which, you know, is a reason why I can live like this right now. You know, but personally, I don't really consider myself as busy because this became just very natural to me.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay.
I'll think that I'm busy, but I'm not sure if I'm really busy. You know,
like this in the sense that it doesn't feel like work in that sense.
Well, it is work, but this is not abnormal to me. So but when you feel like you're busy is when, you know, the workload is overwhelming, you know, beyond what you have been doing. But this is, you know, very natural to me. And I also spend a lot of time with my family. That's what I learned during the course, that I really, really have to also be busy with my family. You can't just be busy with work because, you know, then you're going to be losing something really, really important in your life.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I definitely have been, it's quite clear to me that, you know, we can go through a whole day with, mm-hmm. you know, being busy with meetings and, mm-hmm. and you know, that day is then part of a working week, which we just think of a couple of days and we have our schedule. But for children, mm-hmm. like our young children, still in the context of their life, a day mm-hmm. is relatively long. I mean, it really is compared to us a much longer experience, and so I'm mindful of that that to always make sure that I'm checking with them as much as possible and acknowledging that difference in time perception for sure.
Yeah, I think it's a priority decision. Like the reason why you can't spend time with your family is because you prioritize other things like work or other events, things like that. And you always have a reason. If you do not get these things done, then you can't support the family, whatever when you have a reason. But if you really understand the importance of, you know, spending time with your family, like especially your children, then that's also a very, very important, you know, I would say task or meeting that you can consider relative to your other, you know, meetings.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing that's interesting to see is that parents are often really, you know, having children is a really good way to make yourself hyper-productive because you're still trying to do the same amount of things, but you have extra responsibilities, which you have to squeeze in. All of a sudden, like you said, it's an important meeting. You've got to pick them up at a certain time. You've got to get your stuff done by a certain time. All of a sudden, it's not like, oh, well, you know, if I work late tonight and I'll just order in food and, you know, work late and go straight home, right? As you might if you don't have that responsibility, it's much more structured. So that can be a good thing to avoid letting the work expand to the time available, right? Instead condensing it to the minimum possible time, which is good.
That just reminded me of how I get things done. So I said that I do things ASAP before I forget about it or before it gets piled up, so that, you know, it becomes an obstacle for a thing that might emerge in the future. But also, I simplify things. So I don't do things in a complicated way. I do things in probably a simple way. So that's how I save time. And it probably got me a lot of, you know, practice to simplify doing things, and a lot of courage as well. And the reason probably I was able to simplify you know, things was because I was so busy. I couldn't do it in super details. Then I had to think about what's really important and let's just do the important parts. And I learned that that's sufficient. So if you live a busy life, you have a tendency that you have to be like super detailed, like 100% fully, you know, prepared and things like that. But sometimes if you look at most of the things, I think that's too much. You know, that's not even required.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's a really valuable realization. I also, when I started running my business, also that you can't do it all as well. And, you know, the work that you have decided to focus on for your business is probably the thing that you do relatively best. But if it's restricted and bound by your capacity, then it's not going to be anything more than just you. And that took quite a long time for me to accept. But it is a fact that no one will work as hard or do as much as you, the founder. And that you just have to accept that. Otherwise, you're always chasing the unachievable goal, right?
Yeah. So listening to you, I think that if you cannot simplify work, then probably you can't get a lot of things done. So that means that if you're super, super detailed and you want to be 100% prepared for everything, then you're not going to get anything done probably. And once you start to let go of things by yourself, and once you learn how to delegate stuff, that's when you are able to get things done. But, you know, as a person working really, really hard, the first, you know, fear you will have will be delegate stuff to other people because you can't trust them. You have to confirm.
Right. So tell me a little bit about data crunch. It's got a really good name, which I think reflects very well what it is that you do. But tell us a little bit about the company and the space you're in.
So data crunch is what we do is we crunch data. So that's the reason why we're data crunch. And I was thinking about when I founded this company in 2016, I had to explain what we do very, very simply to our clients. So I was thinking about a name. Because, you know, if I give a name and then if that doesn't explain what we do, then I thought that it would be very hard to do sales. So what we do is, in the company, there's so many operational data and like people crunch data on Excel to generate basic, you know, indicators data for decision-making reporting. And that takes a lot of time. So we have a solution to support that data crunching work. Like, we replace the Excel data crunching, and when you come to the come to work in the morning, all the numbers will be all prepared. So it really accelerates decision, and it also provides numbers that you can't generate with human, you know, labor. So so that business can make better decisions. So we automate data crunching. That's what we do at Data Crunch.
I see. And it is. Are you finding that this is most attractive or most useful to certain sectors, or is it very widely applicable?
So any sector that has sales, inventory management, like SCM, CRM, and production, will require having a interfunctional data set to make decisions. For example, if you want to sell something, you need inventory, right? So then you have to make a sales decision tied with inventory. So you have to have an integrated data set. So that's what we provide. So I would say that most of the companies are relevant in our industry. And I think it's becoming more and more relevant because we made probably a smart decision not to join the AI hype in 2018. Because I was foreseeing that AI, well, we can't compete with Google or OpenAI or Microsoft in AI development, and soon AI will become a cheap infrastructure. So I thought that there was no point getting into that competition. But what's important is AI needs data, and data technology is more important, and it's really hard to replace data technology with AI. Maybe in the future, we might be able to do it, but at least for a couple of years, it's going to be challenging to do that. Mm-hmm. So we were really focusing on data as a strategy.
Okay. And I often hear from large companies that they have so much data that they just don't know what to do with it, right? They can't extract the value. Do you have any kind of stories or situations where you were literally just shocked at a particular company because it was just so basic, so underdeveloped, and yet still such a large organization?
Okay, well, most of organizations are in that state, I would say. The reason why organizations cannot fully utilize data or have a hard time utilizing data is because they ask complicated questions for a complicated problem. So because the problem itself is complicated, and then you're asking complicated questions and trying to have an answer out of it. Like, it's so difficult even just to understand the situation and the solution. So I think that what's more important is asking simple questions, like with common sense, like very, very basic questions that maybe an intern might ask. So those kind of questions are very, very important, I think, for business. Mm-hmm. And if you can answer those kind of basic questions, then it gives you a lot of insight about your problems in operation, your strategy, and how to resolve it. So what fundamentally should be done for all business is answering basic questions, then getting into complicated questions, I would say.
Okay. How do you go about protecting your assets? Because presumably there is quite a lot of data transactions back and forth. How do you go about doing that?
The solution is ours. So we're a tech company. So our solution is our intellectual property. So that's protected. Then it's a question of, can other companies, copy our solution or mimic our solution? I would say that that's very challenging because it's not just a it's not, the technology is not in the reports that we generate, like the columns, the, you know, indicators, the formula. It's about how to integrate different types of data. So that's the real complicated know-how that we have. And we have pre-built models that will connect data set A and data set B. So it will take a lot of time for other companies to catch up in that domain, I would say. So that is our natural entry to barrier in terms of technology, I would say.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Good. Well, long may that continue. What was your vision for the company? Like in what whether you know we term it as a roadmap that you had when you started in 2016, or what was the you know your big goal? But more importantly, how has that evolved into the company that is now?
Okay. So I used to work as a biz analyst at Arthur Andersen, and which became very important later on because it went out of business. And I was working at SAP projects, one of the largest SAP projects at the time. And I was on the process side, but I understood digital at that time and understood that, you know, integrating data to support decision is a huge thing. Like all the systems are fragmented and just integrating data is just a huge thing. And in 2016, like after more than decades, you know, passed, I see that that's still the problem. So it has been a problem in the past, throughout the history of the industry. And then, you know, still it's a problem. And then I was thinking that, okay, why don't we solve it? So that's was the motivation founding DataCrunch. The question of whether we are in the form that we envisioned when I found this company. I'm not sure, but I think that we're definitely going in that direction. Honestly, I did not have time to look back or, think about other things because we were going on that path, you know, every day. So like every day execution, living fully each day was very, very important. And I can't even imagine how 8 years has passed. You know, it just feels like it was yesterday, and then I realized that 8 years has passed because I was only looking at today, tomorrow. And, you know, if you want to climb up, you know, a high mountain like Mount Everest, if you look at the mountain, you're probably not going to get there. You're going to give up. But if you look at your foot, then you'll somehow get there because you're not. Yeah.
Right. The breaking down of the goal to taking that step in front of you, which is just a small step, but when you zoom out, all of a sudden you've taken 1,000 steps and you've made a lot of progress. Yeah, absolutely. And so when you started DataCrunch, was that the first time that you began leading people, or had you had previous leadership experience before?
I had previously founded a company, but I would say that, you know, it was a microbrewery, but I would say that DataCrunch was a more serious business than, I mean, first serious business that I really learned how to, practice leadership, I would say.
Okay.
But I had so much fun, you know, working at that microbrewery at that time.
Yeah. Tell me more about that. When did you do that?
So that was, I think, 3 years or 4 years before. Like 2013-ish. So I had an opportunity to start a small microbrewery for not a long time because I briefly joined then. I came out of the team. But I had to deliver, you know, kegs all over Seoul, and we're thinking about where to sell our beer, you know, the branding and just the vibe at that time. It was the golden ages of craft beer at that time. So it was pretty fun. Yeah, it was. And the reason why I thought that I should do it was because as a consultant, as a consultant, you don't fully understand how business works. You just get into products at a fragmented, you know, piece of the business. But in order to do a microbrewery, you have to look at the full internal value chain from importing hops to, you know, activating pubs that you supply to. So it's production decision, inventory decision, marketing decision, import decision. Then how do you do sales? You know, how do you even activate pubs like, you know, advise them, you know, how to do interior, how to manage customers, etc. So it was a full package of a experience, which became a valuable asset later on when I found Databricks.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, being involved in a startup or establishing your own thing, the one very big similarity with consulting is that the learning curve is very steep because of the intensity of the work. The biggest difference, like you said just before that, though, is that with consulting, you're usually only in a very small part, whereas when it's your own thing, it's A to Z, the entire breadth of activities, which is a challenge in itself. So at the microbrewery, you got some experience with leadership, and then it was Databricks that became your next venture. Mm-hmm. What would you say your leadership style is now?
Full delegate, I would say. Yeah, and I trust my team. That's the reason why I can delegate. So this is what I learned looking back in my life. Like, I had opportunities that I was given, you know, a big role at that time for a young, like, 20 or early 20-year-old. And what I understood is if you have the will to do it and if you are capable of doing it, no matter of how, which level you're at, you will eventually get it done. So the difference between current organizations and Western organizations is that Western organizations first give opportunities, then see if the person can do it or not. Current organizations don't give opportunities until you're super confident that they can do it. So if you look at Western organizations, you become an executive candidate during the 30s, recently, right? And if you're 40s, then you, some are executives already. In Korea, if you're 30 or 40, you're a manager.
Right.
Or sometimes even a junior manager. So, but you know, if you want to grow people, you have to really trust them and give them opportunities. So that's where my full delegation is coming from. And you have to really believe that they are the best talents, right? It doesn't matter if they are or not. You have to really believe that. Then they will make difference. When I was doing KST, like some, you know, labs show extraordinary performance, some labs never perform, right? And when they were admitted, they were all smart students. And I was thinking, why does that variance happen? And I observed one thing, like if the professor really believes that, you know, if my students are really smart, then they would show great potential. Yeah. And, you know, some labs, professors think that you're dumbest, you know, students, and why can't you meet my expectations, etc. Then they become dumb. That's what I observed. Yeah. So if you really want to grow a team, then you have to really trust your team. But the condition is that you hire the right people. Then trust. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, your example there has brought to my mind the animals that are kept in captivity for excessive amount of time, and then they are released into the wild, and they still continue to move in the same way in which they did within their cage, right? Because for them, that is their reality. Even though there are no boundaries anymore, they're free. They're in the wild, but they're still constrained by that mental restriction. You mentioned a key point there that, of course, I'm incredibly interested in, which is finding the right talents, hiring the right talents.
Right.
What's your, what's your main method, or what's some of your key experiences from hiring people over the last 8 years?
So I think that you can really read person's, you know, characteristics through the resume. So like how you write the resume tells a lot about someone, I think. So it just shows the character, I would say. Like there are like very, very strange resumes, like no capital letters, or like, I would say, you know, there's warning signs in resumes. So I first look at that. And when you do a coffee chat, you express how good you're at, how smart you are, but you can hide a lot of things as well. Mm-hmm. But you can't hide body language, I would say. So I read through the body language and facial expressions. That's where I really get information about the candidate, I would say.
So those
small things really make difference, I would say, like how you write your resume, your body language, yeah, facial expression, etc.
So my immediate worry is that if more and more resumes get written using AI and ChatGPT, that's going to reduce that as a sign, I guess.
Probably, yeah, but you know, still, like, so that I think I read two things from the resume, like the character of the person and the past dependency of the candidate. Like the experience also cannot lie, and I can tell which kind of situation the candidate is in from, you know, reading of the history of the candidate. I'll try to understand why the candidate is trying to either get a job or transfer from the existing company, and experience itself, the past dependency, I think explains a lot.
All right, let me flip that around. What's the biggest red flag that you see on a resume that makes you just instantly, this is not going to work?
I would say that most of the people agree, but if you're frequently moving between companies, then for a very, very high chance that's going to happen after we hire them. So that's the initial...
What's frequent for you in your mind? What are we talking when you're saying frequent?
Like, you know, in the past, like, people would work more than 3 years in a company and things like that. But it's very challenging to find talents that have that tenure. If you are moving between jobs like every year, then that's, you know, probably a red flag, I would say. And second is, like, there's sometimes they write something that is totally not conventional, I would say. For example, yeah, I don't want to give specific details, but if the courier is totally out of the line of expectation, then that will signal whether either that person is, you know, creative, or, you know, that person tries to try a lot of things, but it also signals fragility. So
you mean very different and unconnected types of work in sequence. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It can be a good thing, but at the same time, it can be a risky thing for the company.
Yeah.
But a company is not trying to hire an entrepreneur, I would say. In a company, like, you know, entrepreneurial spirit will definitely help moving things forward.
Mm-hmm.
But we are looking for someone that will fit in the team. So those kind of, you know, strange career path might signal something that's, you know, provides information about the candidates, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. I think for me, the frequent moving, it's clearly a trend, like a trend for everybody to move more often. And I think that's reflection of the way in which, you know, the speed of technology and also global mobility, of course, is at its highest level than ever before. You know, if I think back to my first three jobs, they were in three different countries with three different organizations and three different industries. I would say, but that was early on in my career, and you know, I was trying to establish what it is that I want to do and what I'm good at, and I was just trying everything I could to get that breadth of experience, and then of course there's always certain roles where staying long is actually diminishing performance as well, right? Like, you know, maybe sales, you know, can be one example there. But it's always I always think back to a candidate that I was interviewing for another position, for a position on behalf of a client, and he said that he was looking for a stable company. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, what does stable mean to you? And he said, very big. And I said, okay, like what? Give me an example. And he named, I'm not going to say the company name, but he named a very large company. And I said, okay, that's interesting. Well, this company is not a big company. It's just not big. But the funny thing is that the very next year, that company went out of business.
Okay. Wow.
And so I just thought, you know, size is not always an absolute guarantee for stable. That in his mind he was looking for, right? I think sometimes we can perceive things which in the grand scheme of things they nothing is forever, and where we are a year from now is going to be different. Where we are 2 years from now again will be different, and kind of like reevaluating, because also companies are not offering a job for life at the same time, right? So it seems somewhat like unbalanced that companies want people to say that they're going to stay forever, but they're not guaranteeing the job forever. Right. So
yeah, that's also the area that I'm thinking really deeply in and try to find a solution. I mean, find a model of a sustainable organization, of how we can retain people for longer. And I understood that, you know, first we have to understand that the reason why people work at a company is to make a living. So if you can't make them make a living, then it really doesn't work as a, you know, employment. So what do you mean by make a living? Is it's not just simply making money to support the family, but work and family events or your important personal events should somehow be harmonized in the work setting. So as a small company, what I first understood is that although we try to invite great talents, their wives or husbands or, you know, parents would ask like, what? I never heard of that company, it's so small.
Right.
And you have to persuade, you know, so the decision maker is not the candidate.
Right.
The decision maker is your spouse or your parent or your relative, your friend that influences you.
Right.
That influences your family, right? Then in a small company, it was really important to build a culture that we accommodate those kind of family events, needs in a work setting. Yeah, so that's one of our top priorities when we consider work, family first. So, like, we're not Samsung Electronics or Google that people sacrifice their lives to just, you know, get the name. So that was really, really important. And also thinking about how do we make people believe that this is a place that we can settle down as a, you know, career or a workplace. And that all boiled down to a, you know, question of how do we prioritize family matters. So that was really something important, because if you look at why modern day's organization see a lot of, you know, frequent talent flights or, you know, frequent shorter tenures, is because the premises that the company will take care of, you know, the employees, you know, lives, right? Lives has probably, you know, torn down, you know, since probably 2000 or things like that. So that's a reason why people don't also see that I should stay here longer enough.
What's your take? A lot of companies over the years have tried to say, oh, we're a family. We take care of you. No one left behind. We're integrated like a real family. And there's a contrary opinion, which is like, we don't want to be a family, because in a family, there's always that awkward uncle that nobody likes, but because they're your family, because they're your relation, you have to put up with them just because they're family. And even though everybody would be better off separate, they're family, so they stay there and you know, no one's really happy. Right. Instead of that, to be a high-performing team, like a sports team, where there's a coach and then there's selected players. And every player is competing to stay on the team, knowing that for the best outcome, for the best team performance, the best set of players is needed. And there's probably a point where that player realizes that they are no longer able to deserve that spot. And they even kind of like stand down or at least are fully aware that there are others who can do it better. And so operating as a kind of high performing sports team, what's your, as a business owner, where do you stand on that front?
Okay, so we think that family matters are very important for our members, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we should be families within our companies.
Okay.
We value family matters of the members, but we're not a family. But we want to be a community. So family and community, I think, is very different. Like community shares common values, and it has a reciprocal norm to help out each other. So we're trying to build, and I believe that we have somehow built, a reciprocal relationship between the our members and the company. Mm-hmm. In a sense that the company takes care, prioritizes family matters. In return, when the company is at stake, you know, please let's all pull up our sleeves and get things done. The question is, how do we get things done? So building that reciprocal norm within the within the company as a community was the top priority of as an organization culture. And although we're not family, I think believe that we're a community that will try to help out each other. And what was really important in that sense is, you know, performance evaluation really kills the vibe, I would say. Like, so you hire people that are good enough and that you believe that they're good enough. Of course, you can't maintain a member that's, you know, never going to meet the performance. But people can perform well and perform bad based on so many factors, right? If your family is sick, then no matter how much you're good at, you're going to perform bad. They all have reasons. They're not just trying to exploit the company. They have a reason. So if you know how to wait, build that reciprocal culture, then they would contribute, I would say.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. And I think the hard thing as a business owner is that often it's a matter of that moment, and that moment where the reality is it doesn't really matter if that particular thing doesn't get done at that precise moment. Like in real terms, it doesn't really matter. And so I try, and it's not easy, but I just try to flex time plans and deadlines accordingly. If these things happen, because like you say, the person is essentially being unintentionally affected by an external influence, and that is often in most cases the primary reason for a change in performance. Well, we have I think almost run out of time there, Eric. There was one final question that I wanted to ask you in relation to transferable skills, because like we started our talk about how you have different roles in different environments, and transferable skills, of course, the skills which are not technical specific to one area, but are literally transferable, the things which can be applied to any working environment. What do you consider to be the most valuable transferable skill? Either take it for yourself as a business leader, or that you look for in when you're hiring.
Okay, so I think that communication and planning capability is very, very important. It doesn't necessarily mean that I'm an expert in that domain. I just think that those kind of two things are so important, either for an individual to excel in their career or as an organization or a company. If you, like some people do not understand the importance of communication, of following, updating what you have done to others, not to create a silo, is very important. And also planning is very important. Surprisingly, you'll see that a lot of people struggle when they're required to plan their work. The initial response will be, you know, I've never done this before. How can I even build a plan, right? So I don't know how long it's going to take yet. But those structural thinking is very important. Like first thinking with why do we have to do this? And if you understand why, then you can think about what you have to do. Then how should we do it? like who should we do it with and what is the deadline. So then recursively, how do we plan out each items? So, but usually people start from what or how level. They don't think about the why level, and the why level provides a structural thinking. So you have to have a structural mindset to actually plan out things. So doing things in detail is very important, I would say. Mm-hmm. But what is more important is having a structural mindset of thinking about how do we design work? Like, what is my work in relation with others' work in the organization and stuff like that?
Got it. Got it. Well, I think clearly you said that you're maybe not the best at this, but you clearly do have a very high level because you've been able to, you know, get so much done and maintain several roles simultaneously whilst running your own business, which is all consuming at the same time, whilst also having a family, traveling, and then also making public appearances. So kudos to you, Eric. That's all we have time for today. So thank you so much for being with us, and hope that everyone has enjoyed this podcast. And on that note, let's get stuff done.
Thank you for listening to the Get Stuff Done podcast. If you would like to be a guest in the future, please do reach out. Or if you would like to recommend someone, that would be awesome as well. Make sure you keep listening, as we will be bringing you fresh insights every week, because getting stuff done is something everyone needs.